Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, September 22nd, 2016. Tonight, I believe this will be the last episode dealing with math of the world population. And of course, there's a lot of interest in this all around. Somebody sent me a link. There's some kind of a contest. People are supposed to make a 60-second video or something like this. And the first thing they point to is global climate change. Oh, that gets stuck in everywhere. It's so absurd. They want to push that and push it and push it. Let's just make something very, very clear. The world population is a result of two things. Number one, after the last Earth-wide disaster, which was many thousands of years ago, as I've explained on this show, the population centers of Earth were in what is now northern India and northwest China, up in the mountainous regions, and that's why those countries got a head start. The second reason is world banking. That keeps the world population in absolute dirt poverty, and that breeds population growth. You look at the high population growth areas of the world, that is what's going on. I mean, it's just a one-to-one correlation. You can't even argue with it. And you find that the so-called developed nations that have high living standards are having falling population growth. So there's no question. The only difference now is that the United States has about 50 million illegal aliens who are having babies like crazy. So instead of 270 million people, which we had a decade ago, we have 340 million people, and it's an absolute population bomb going off. So at any rate, tonight is the last episode. First of all, a couple quick announcements. If you have been watching mainstream media and have not been watching alternative media, Hillary Clinton has a number of doubles that are stepping in for her. These women look 20 years younger. They don't even talk like her. I mean, there's so many dissimilarities. They're thinner, shorter, and I mean, they don't have the facial features. But what they do, it's kind of like Saturday Night Live. They take that cast of characters and they can make them look like Bill Clinton or George Bush or whoever they want to make them up to be, or Obama or whatever. They can make these people look so close, and you know, it's comical because you know who they are because they're the actors there. But they can take people, and these people already look similar. And by the way, you might think, oh, this is conspiracy theory. Well, let me tell you something, it's not. And the second thing is that all of the world leaders have doubles. This is nothing unusual. It's just that the reason world political leaders have doubles is for security reasons. They have them there because they would stand in or divert attention so that people who are after them, so to speak, would be fooled. And then not kill the real leader. It's a matter of security and protection. But when you have somebody on the campaign trail that's falling down, having seizures, can't complete sentences, needs somebody to come up and whisper in their ear, it's okay, keep talking. And then they, you know, she comes out of it. And there's so many stations covering this, but I'm talking about the people who have not heard about any of this. And I've been in the loop on a lot of communications between a number of top-level people in the country on this, including senators, ex-senators, talk show hosts, and it's very well understood. So anyway, this has gotten out of control, but anyway, this has led up to the situation we're seeing today. So I won't say any more about that. I'm not going to waste this time on politics, but this is a very important point for people to understand. And anyway, I'm not going to talk any more about that. But if you're not aware of that, certainly become aware, because there's plenty of information out there. It's not conspiracy theory. I've been able to verify this myself. And it's a very bizarre situation. When I was a kid, we used to joke about futuristic things. One was that you'd have to, if you were standing on a street corner, some guy'd walk up to you and, where's your license to be here? Where's your license to breathe? And you'd have to pull out this great big thick wallet, and here's your, all your different licenses to be there, to breathe, whatever. We were kidding. We're there now today. And the other thing we kidded about was that they might elect Howdy Doody for president someday. Just this talking woodhead that would be president. Well, I think we're there, folks. Anyway, enough of that. And by the way, on last week's Paidcast, it was about Tesla's mind, his invention, the Tesla turbine. I've posted more information on the webpage. So if you're a member of the Paidcast, go there. I have a PDF of Tesla's early inventions up to around the 1913 timeframe. It's very incomplete. It only has his very early inventions, some of the very simple ones, but very important ones, including, you'll probably have a hard time believing this, but Tesla invented the not only the speedometer, but test head units in which, like, say you might have pressure gauges or you might have other sensors that then feed into a dial. Tesla invented these. He also invented the vertical takeoff helicopter and airplane. We call them VTOLs, vertical takeoff and landing, but then when they get up, they convert into a regular flying craft. Tesla invented this using his Tesla turbine. Anyway, I won't say a lot about that, but just go to the webpage. You can download the Paidcast webpage. You can download the PDF file of, it's a kind of a large file, around 42 megabytes, of Tesla's early inventions, and it's really interesting reading. And next week, I decided to make another episode of Tesla's Mind about the Tesla turbine, and I'm going to be examining the May 6, 1913 patent, where Tesla patents his Tesla turbine, and examining that and showing how he also invented the solar cell. This guy was all over the place. I mean, and the way this guy was treated in life ends up penniless, living in a hotel room. Anyway, I won't go into that, but just bizarre. Just bizarre. But this guy was so intelligent. He was producing patents on a daily basis. His brain was going 100 miles an hour. Just a reminder, the red letter sale on the water filter stuff is still on, and I've left it up there. I'm just taking a hit on profit here so you people can get a good deal on water filter elements. And the sales are, it's going quite well, so I'm just going to leave it up there for a while. It's going to have to come down eventually, but I want you people to get good prices on water filters, on water filter, especially the replacement filter elements. My GF replacement filter elements are going crazy, so I'm not going to spend any more time talking about that now, but go there to the sales page, jmccsci.com. Red letter sale is still on. And this week's Paidcast, by the way, is part two of radiation and you talking about the status of radiation in the United States and around the world. Kind of an update, very important, because I get into some detail about the situation in the United States, and it's dire. Let me just put it that way. Yesterday, the report came out, or 2 days ago, I believe it was, in Park County, Florida. A facility that made fertilizer, phosphate fertilizers, had an immense disaster. There was a sinkhole, and apparently, what they were doing is pumping water into the ground as part of their runoff from their plant. And this created a massive sinkhole. What it was doing was eroding the sand away underneath the ground, and all of a sudden, kawooey, and all of this polluted water, including radiotoxic water, has now fallen into the Florida water table for fresh water. This is a absolute national disaster. And it was bound to happen. All I can tell you is that I'll be talking more about that on the paid cast this week also. By the way, if you haven't joined the paid cast, you know, you got to do this, especially if you got kids or people in kids in school, any level, you know, grade school to university. The amount of information in this paid cast is phenomenal. Okay, on to the main science topic. Oops, one more topic. Standing Rock Reservation in this pipeline opposition thing is going on. Get tuned to that. I won't say a lot about that here, but what's going on, there's a lake there that's also reservation and holy ground for the indigenous people that live in that area. They're trying to defend their homeland against this pipeline, which is going to, you know, if there's an accident, and these do have accidents, and over time it would have an accident, just statistically it would have an accident there, it would literally destroy these people's lands and lake and water supply, everything. And so they're opposing it. Of course, the private companies are trying to push this through along with their buddies in the federal government. Go and check that out. Standing Rock, and support those indigenous people up there. They need your help, because this is, you know, the lobbyists in Congress, the corporations are putting this through, and it's a complex legal issue. But you have to understand, here's the issue. If the pipeline goes on land that is not on the reservation, but has the potential to pollute, to cross over and pollute lands, then these people have a right. If there was some kind of magic wall there where any pollution that came out of this pipeline would stop, you'd say, okay, there's the magic wall. It's not going to hurt you at all. But we all know there is no magic wall. And those pipelines break, it's going to break, it's going to pollute their land, it's going to pollute their water supply, and they are standing up. So this is going to, they're right now trying to use legal means, but if that doesn't work, and I have a feeling, well, I'm not going to give any predictions, but I just go and get tuned to that. I'm not going to say any more about that now. Just become tuned, and you know, if you see fit, support those indigenous people up there to protect their lands. And, you know, we don't need any of this energy. That's the problem. The energy for profit business should not have ever gotten off the ground. Okay, off to the main science topic. And tonight I'm going to complete my thought. All of what I've been doing up to now is building up kind of the basis, kind of the fun facts, so to speak, about world population. But tonight I'm going to go into the modification of world population with the worldwide. And I actually started that last week. I started talking about volcanic activity. But this week I'm going to take it a step further and talk about the population centers, what could happen if such and such. And but first of all, I've got a few corrections. Just modifications of things that I've said in the past couple weeks. And just as a review, by the way, the September shows, September 1st, 8th, 15th, 22nd, all are the shows dealing with the world population issue. A few modifications of what I said previous weeks. I said that an area 500 miles by 500 miles would be enough area to grow organic food, non-GMO food, for the entire world. Now, this is an incredible statement. However, this would be in an area such as, say, Iowa, where you had a single growing season. If you have two growing seasons, cut that in half. You'd have 500 miles by 250-mile area, which is actually probably around the size of the state of Iowa. If you had three seasons, such as in the tropics, and a lot of the people of the world, the bulk of the population, lives within that zone where you'd have two or three growing seasons, and of course, dependent on the elevation also, but that would give you, with three season growing seasons, three seasons per year, an area of 500 miles by 167 miles. And so that is an incredible fact, that all of the food for the world could be grown in that small an area. Compare that to the landmass of the world, and now you have countries that, look at the agricultural area of the United States. It's now under agriculture of high production GMO corn and soybeans, etc. And why do we have world starvation? Why do most people in the world not have food? Do you think this is because of large-scale production or agriculture? How can we possibly grow the amount of food that is growing in these states across the breadbasket of the United States and have world hunger on a large scale? It is beyond morality. It is beyond belief. I'm going to modify a little bit of what I said last week. I said if you took all the 7 billion plus people in the world and you lined them up back to back, or like not back to back, but in a line, and so they're really kind of smooshed together. They're just only room back to back, or the people are lined up in a line. And really you would need a line that went to the moon and back to give enough space for the population. That includes kids, adults, everybody. But that line of people, 7 billion people, would stretch to the moon and back. Now, look around you. You know, if you're living in a developed country, and even if you go into what you might call a crowded area like an airport, imagine there are so many people in the world, and you look at a place like China or India, these places are packed with people. And when you start lining them up, just China and India, with a roughly just about 3 billion people between the two of them, they would stretch single-handedly to the moon, almost to the moon, those two countries. And then the rest of the world, the population of the rest of the world, would have to go out to the rest of the moon, the distance to the moon, and come back. But yeah, you would need a line, because here's what happens if you have 7 billion people and you give them the distance to the moon to line up. They only have around a little under 3 inches per person. And how do you get that number? It's 250,000 miles to the moon. There's 5,280 feet in a mile. Figure it out. Divide by 7 million people. And how much distance per person? And it comes out to be a little bit under 3 inches per person if you put those 7 billion out to the moon. So really you'd need to go out to the moon and come all the way back. 7 billion people, that's a lot of people. Most of them living in dire poverty. And even at that, giving them a line out to the moon and all the way back would only give 6 inches per person, about. So at any rate, another little fun fact here. How about water? The use of fresh water. Now, water is greatly misused. Let me give you a little fun fact about California. We all know that California has had a drought and that they were conserving water and people were getting fined for watering their lawns, all kinds of things. And they had to conserve, you know, not take as many showers or whatever. But every day in Los Angeles, every day, flushing the toilet uses more water than the annual requirement for water per person in Los Angeles. Literally, they were flushing their fresh, clean water down the toilet. Enough in one day to supply all of their water needs for a year. So multiply that times 365. There is not a water shortage. And I've said all along that you take human waste, you mix it with water, a lot more water, and now you got all this water is polluted. You have just polluted a gallon or two of water with a little teeny bit of water. And that water is not even the bad part. The solid waste can be dried. and taken out, and once it's dried, it can actually be used for compost, because once the bacteria break down, once it's broken down sufficiently. And so there is not a water shortage problem in the world, even in drought-stricken California. It is a water management problem. But let's look at the world population. 7 billion people out there using water. The World Health Organization says that 5 gallons of fresh water, of clean fresh water, per day is the minimal amount per person. How much water is that for 7 billion people? It's a cube of water, this is daily, a cube of water 1/3 mile on a side. So you take 1/3 of a mile, 1/3 of a mile, and 1/3 of a mile cube, and a cube of that size, that's the amount of water it would take to give everybody in the world 5 gallons of water. Now, industrial use, Western developed country use, where they use literally hundreds of gallons per day, start multiplying that out. These are vast amounts of fresh water. A lot of this water comes from underground, in the developed world at least. And so we're using this water and then returning it in a very polluted state. And when I talk about environment and you, that's another part of the Paidcast series. The name of that Paidcast series is called Environmental Toxins. I will be talking a lot about specific environmental toxin, and there's just so many. The reason I'm somewhat of an expert in this, of course, is because of my water filters, which take out, these are designed to remove all of these toxins. So to do that, you have to understand where the toxins come from, how much there is, how to build the water filter so that it takes out those toxins for the lifetime of the filter element. And so anyway, having toxicity of water is something I happen to know quite a bit about. But imagine that you take that quantity of water every day, mix it with toxins, human waste, chemicals, pharmaceuticals, and then have industrial settings, and this all gets dumped back in the ground. Agriculture is horrible. I just had a question, a person wrote in about estrogen. They were concerned about estrogen levels in the water, and it's becoming increasingly a problem all over, especially in the United States, where there's a lot of agriculture. And there's some misnomers about where this comes from. A very, very small percentage, although it's real, comes from birth control pills. But the amount of estrogen given to livestock, this is one of the main sources. Plus, there are lots of chemicals used in industry that simulate estrogen, especially those that are used in plastics. And so that's why plastic pollution is an immense problem, because once that gets buried, once it gets into a landfill, that is going to leach and leach and leach until that plastic breaks down someday, you know, maybe in 100 years, in a couple hundred years, it's all going to break down and get into the water table. And so those estrogen-like compounds that do the same thing, like BPA, once it gets into your system, then the toxicity level is raising. But those are the main sources of estrogen-like compounds, and so people are drinking this. And it has negative effects on both women and men, and it's a great factor in infertility. So, and I've given a talk before also, and when I talked about toxic levels in my Paidcast session on environmental toxins, one of those sessions was on glyphosates, which does the same thing. It destroys fertility, especially in males. Okay, so on to natural disasters and the effect on population. I talked last week about volcanoes, and the wind direction from volcanoes. Typically, the people that live to the upwind side of volcanoes have very little effect. The people that live downwind, especially close, have a tremendous negative effect. And volcanic ash can carry, for example, Mount St. Helens. People were able to fill up little vials of Mount St. Helens ash in New York City. So there's some other issues. We have nuclear reactors today. If there is a general shutdown of infrastructure in the United States has 50% of the world's nuclear reactors, if you can imagine that. And if the infrastructure shuts down, then you can't get fuel to the nuclear reactors, or it might be flooding. There might be other conditions that prevent the nuclear reactors from operating. They require cooling to keep the casks cool because they're using new high-octane nuclear fuel, and they require cooling. If they're not cooled continuously, they melt down, and then it's in the environment, in the air, in the water supply, devastating for wide areas of the world population. And nuclear fuel keeps spreading, like Fukushima has poisoned the Pacific Ocean. Talking about flooding, tsunamis, etc. But let me give you another little fun fact here. On average, 60% of the world populations live in cities. That is an astounding number. And you find that the high concentrations of people living in cities are once again in the impoverished countries. The United States is fairly high. But remember that the United States, we think of that as the gold, the country of absolute gold standard. But in real terms, the United States is literally a third world country right now. 60% of the people living on Earth today, 60% live very near coastlines. And that's why I'm mentioning this now that I'm talking about tsunamis. Let's take a look at, for example, the Canary Islands, off there, sitting off the west coast of Africa. Through historical times, the Canary Islands have had underwater shelf. They're called, in geological terms, they're called sloughs. And what happens is a large chunk of earth slides down the embankment, and that moving land causes a tremendous tidal wave. Some of that comes back on the Canary Islands themselves and over to Africa, but the majority of that surge of the tsunami wave that is generated comes towards the United States. In his book called Atlantis in the Antediluvian World, the lieutenant governor of Minnesota in the mid-1800s, Ignatius Donnelly, and by the way, I've got a copy of this book. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. It's so filled with information. But he makes it clear. He grew up in the Pennsylvania fields, out in the oil and coal fields of Pennsylvania. And remember that in the early days of oil in the United States, even in the 1800s, Pennsylvania oil, that's where the term Pennzoil comes from, and the Rockefellers, and then later the Bushes, etc., they were all oil people. They were involved in oil. And Pennsylvania was one of the first deposits of oil where they found it, and then, of course, once you keep digging and digging, you find the deposits that sank in after the large comet encounters. That's where surface oil comes from, is our encounters with large comets. That's where the deep oil comes from also, and then the Earth has piled up on top of that over time. And so what would happen, those large deposits of oil would actually sink into the ground via the surface layer, and then the dirt would continue building up and building up and building up over, you know, millennia. And so now we have oil deposits that are literally 18 kilometers under the surface of the Earth. So they had to come up with this ridiculous concept called abiotic oil, in which they say, oh, it just forms from chemicals that are down there. Well, you can take those chemicals in a laboratory and form something that looks like oil, but all of the benzenes, all of those chemicals, all of the low carbon chain hydrocarbons, you're not going to form down deep in the earth. But and it would always be it would be localized. How do you get all of those essential elements together? Because really nothing moves down there. So how do you get all these essential elements together to get deposits of oil? And you don't. Abiotic oil is a myth, absolute myth. But they needed something to take the place of dinosaur bones and fern forest, because it became so patently obvious. There's so many contradictions there, it doesn't even begin to make sense. Well, they got away with teaching that for about 40 years in university level science, geology. But back to Ignatius Donnelly in Pennsylvania. He noticed as a kid, as they dug up the coal layers, there would be a layer of coal, then a layer of gravel, then a layer of coal, layer of gravel, etc. They came in layers. Well, if you combine that, your understanding now is that these were created by big tsunamis that came in off the Atlantic Ocean. If you understand where Pennsylvania is in relative to the Atlantic Ocean, the coal fields in central Pennsylvania are, a long way from the ocean. So these tidal waves were big. And what they did is they just scooped up all of the plant matter and dumped it as it came, as those waves came up and hit hills, etc. And if you think this is myth, a number of years ago there was a tsunami that came off of the Sumatra in the Indian Ocean, the right side of the Indian Ocean, the east side, I should say, of the Indian Ocean. And that tsunami went across the Indian Ocean and hit Madagascar. The tsunami came in and took all of the vegetation, literally all of it, like a big bulldozer, and dumped it in a big pile. That someday will be dry oil without any oil content. The oil, the coal that we see today, the deposit in Madagascar will be coal that's dry, no oil content. The coal that we see sometimes today with very high, very obnoxious levels of chemicals is because it was raining in from the comet tail. When the comet came by that created the tsunami, and not all of the tsunamis were created by comets, because the, for example, the ones in the Canary Islands could have been natural events, just these natural, regular occurring slewing events that occur off the Canary Islands. India is another place that has tsunamis, but it has a long, flat coastline, so the material gets piled up and probably just stays on the surface and decays. It doesn't really get piled up into deposits like up against the side of a hill and to turn into coal eventually. So you have to understand all of the various situations under which coal is formed or the tsunamis occur and coal is not formed. But be that as it may, Pennsylvania has layers and layers of coal from repeated tsunamis that came in off the Atlantic Ocean. So anyway, the reason I'm mentioning this is because a tsunami from the Canary Islands would have about 6 hours notice for the people living on the east coast of the United States. And I have developed maps based on the altitude of the land, the topographic maps of the land, and then all the way down to Florida. And it's very clear that the United States would lose probably in one day close to 50 million people if one of these Canary Island tsunamis or landslide slewing events occurred. Around 50 million people. And that's all the way from Maine and Nova Scotia all the way down to the tip of Florida through the Key West, etc. And of course that wave would keep going and hit Mexico. But Mexico does not have that large population centers on the eastern coast. It has population centers, but not massive population centers. The Mexican population is spread around the country, and of course, a big chunk of it now resides in Mexico City. Of the 120 million estimated residents of Mexico, probably 20% of them live in the district, the federal district of Mexico City. So, and then sprinkle around in other medium-sized cities in around the countryside, the eastern coast and the Caribbean coast of Mexico is not that highly populated. So Mexico would not be hit that hard as would happen in the United States. But yeah, my estimate is that 50 million people would be lost in a day. Now, I just wanted to mention a couple other natural disaster type of events. Earthquakes, we all know about the San Andreas Fault. We all know about the St. Louis San Madrid Fault that runs through the St. Louis, Missouri area. Largest earthquake in the U.S. history was there. Remember that we have the Yellowstone volcano, which is we don't nobody knows, nobody can really predict. But if that goes, it's going to kill off most of the United States. One has to wonder, when you look at all the potential natural disasters that are going on, what on earth, how on earth the human population has gotten to where we are today. But it's a miracle, a modern miracle of television and bad science that give people the impression that we have been here for millions of years and nothing has happened and the earth is just great and we might have a little ups and downs or possibly some climate change, but don't ever think about anything big coming into this solar system, Planet X type of objects, or Comet X, I should actually say. Are there safe places in the world? The answer is maybe. There's a lot of people who believe, like, the Appalachian Mountains down on the southern end is a good place. That I would say absolutely is. And I know people that have moved into those areas. I know people that have lived there for quite some time. But it's far enough away from the ocean and the Gulf of Mexico that any slewing that's going on there of the ocean, any washing, so to speak, from those big basins of water would probably not make it beyond the Appalachian mountain chain. It's very difficult to say, unless these were large comets, in which case that's not going to be your only problem. How many people could survive? Now, let's take a comet coming through the solar system. And on a previous show, I did a number of shows where I talked about the size of the object, the mass of the object, the electrical discharge effects, the magnetic effects of a large passing comet. And all of these put together, it's a very, very earth-shattering event. And in the last one, some people lived through it. But there's no reason to believe that in the future anybody might live through a celestial encounter of this magnitude. And remember, let me be very specific. I'm not saying that there's anything on its way now. I'm not saying that tomorrow or next week or in a month or in a year or 10 years or in 100 or even in 1,000 years. I'm not saying that anything is going to happen. But what I will say is that someday in the future, it will happen. So if you take all of the items I've talked about, including water pollution, volcanoes, nuclear reactors shutting down and then going off and leaking, flooding, tsunamis, earthquakes, things like stripping Earth's magnetic field, which will destroy our protection so that the solar wind comes in, causing X-ray damage. In other words, the X-ray signature of Earth would increase, and you would be subject to X-ray exposure. Are there any safe places? No. there are places that might be better than other places, but there's no guarantees because that place could get hit by a massive interplanetary lightning bolt coming from a comet and be the worst place to be. But there's one thing that you can say for certain. You do not want to, if you're concerned about, let me just backtrack a little bit. If you are concerned about Planet X celestial types of events, there is a certain place you don't want to be, and that's living full-time by the coast. And, of course, it would appear that you might have quite a bit of warning if something like this were going to happen. But if a large comet came through the solar system, which actually has happened, as with Hale-Bopp, Hale-Bopp was a very large comet. The nucleus of Hale-Bopp is estimated, based on my work and the recognition of what Harrington did, etc., the mass of the nucleus of Hale-Bopp was about 4 Earth masses, which is a very massive object in outer space. So tidal waves in the land, tidal waves in the ocean, mountain building, volcanoes going off, nuclear reactors shutting down, flooding, tsunamis over large sea areas, and Earth's magnetic field being pulled. All of these major effects. And by the way, the magnetic effects have nothing to do with so-called pole shifts. It's just the fact that the radiation from the sun, you would be a lot more susceptible to radiation from the sun if Earth's magnetic field were not as strong, etc. So anyway, those are other possible effects, not necessarily, but these are all things that could combine in certain areas or multiple effects. So what I'm going to do now is go through the United States populations, and if people live in other parts of the world, they can also use these same factors to determine if they live in what might be called a dangerous area. I'm not going to talk about safe areas, where some place is supposedly the safest and that's where you should move to. I'm going to talk about the most dangerous places, the places that you for sure would not want to be. And, you know, I'm not telling people to get up and move, because this is the extreme situation of a large planetary object coming through, and of course it's going to look like a large comet and have other effects such as electrical effects. Those are major effects, where the electrical discharges come, also the alteration of the atmosphere, where we would have either a large pollution event or somehow have our atmosphere change drastically. Those are other effects that's going, those will affect everybody in the world. It doesn't matter where you live. So once again, I'm not trying to expound upon safe areas. I'm rather talking about places that you really would not want to be, places that are really not safe. So once again, here we are talking about the U.S. map, and I'm going to go over the map area by area. Let's start on the West Coast. These are the major population areas, and if you look on the maps that I've provided, right now I'm looking at the blue map. It's basically the, let me see, it's called the United States Population Density. Seattle, Portland, Seattle, Washington, Portland, Oregon. These are both right smack dab in the middle of the cascade chain of volcanoes. So definitely not good place to be. Spokane, Washington, the same issue. You are right downrange from about 25 major volcanoes. Same with Boise, Idaho. And how far those will reach is a major question. In Wyoming, you have the Yellowstone caldera, which could, if it went off, could cover an area as far east as eastern Nebraska or into the Dakotas, into Minnesota. Okay, now looking down the west coast to California, the absolute bulk of the population of California lives in San Francisco and Los Angeles. Fresno is inland a bit, but then there's a problem with the valley there, the big valley that goes down through Central California, in that it is a basin and could be subject to severe flooding. But LA, San Francisco, look at those peaks right by the ocean. The Pacific Ocean is deep. If that sloshes inwards, those cities would simply disappear. Now, we've discovered that there are cities on the west coast of Peru, and they discovered these by satellite. They discovered the extension of these cities, where there were possibly as many as 40 million people living back in, who knows, they really don't know, but of course many thousands of years ago. There's nothing left. There's not even a potsherd left. And so what happened is those populations were completely washed away by large tsunamis. In other words, this could have been during the Venus event, but South America was heavily, heavily populated, and that would have been one of the very high-level population growth areas like China and India. As I said before, if you take and put your fingers at the Old North Pole, I did this on a previous show, at the Old North Pole north of the state of Michigan in the province of Ontario, and put your finger on the other side of the globe, then if you spin the globe with those as the Old North and South Pole axis poles, then you will find that China and India were on the old equator. So was South America. But the problem is South America has the Pacific Ocean right there, and most of the high population areas live right next to the coastline. Phoenix, Arizona, Las Vegas, two population centers, and a little bit on Tucson down there. But one place that might fare not too poorly is Tucson, oddly enough. Phoenix, it's difficult to say, but Las Vegas, once again, but out in the desert, not a lot of water. Those are very dry areas naturally. So if you had a source of water, plus you may not know this, but along that whole region of western United States, there's a lot of semi-active volcanoes. These volcanoes could become active. El Paso, Texas, Albuquerque, New Mexico, possibly far enough east that those western U.S. volcanoes would not affect them. Far enough inland that possibly washing up from the ocean would not affect them. Of course, Mexico sits due south of them. So Albuquerque, New Mexico, El Paso, Texas, might not fare that badly. Salt Lake City, once again, a very arid area west of the Yellowstone caldera, quite a bit east of the Cascade Range volcanoes. Salt Lake City, if it were not so dry, might not be that bad a place. Denver and Colorado Springs, there again, they are right in the path, directly in the path of Yellowstone volcano, if that goes off. Here's an interesting population notice here. It says Wyoming has the lowest population density of all states in the lower 48, with an average of 5 people per square mile. And if you've ever been out to Wyoming, absolutely. Okay, so back to the map here, going east. Amarillo, Texas, Lubbock, Texas, and Midland, Texas. Those three towns would fare possibly quite well. Population centers, Dallas could fare quite well. Oklahoma City, Tulsa, Oklahoma, could possibly fare quite well. I'm not sure the earthquake activity that's been going on there is quite rare. It's not something that's historically, well, there, of course, we don't have a big record going back hundreds or thousands of years regarding earthquake activity there. Wichita, Kansas, possibly a place that could survive quite well. Houston, Texas, not the place to be. Absolutely not. Austin, Texas, there again, a population center, inland far enough away from those western volcanoes, far enough south from the Wyoming massive volcanoes. So San Antonio, Austin, Texas, possibly faring pretty well. Southern Texas or Central Texas, possibly not that bad a place to be. Let's go north again. Minneapolis, Minnesota. Not that bad a place to be. Technically, a lot of food there. Minnesota has its own food source, still has relatively good soil, water, lots of natural water, surface water under the ground type of water, underground water source. It has Lake Superior, it has access to the ocean. Minnesota, Iowa, may not be, maybe places that would be very survivable. If you took Minneapolis, I believe Minneapolis, Minnesota, if you put a pin, if you took a flat cardboard piece of cardboard and you cut out the North American continent and put a balance point and balanced it, that balance point would end up right around Minneapolis, Minnesota. Oddly enough, Minnesota is the most central state in the of the 48 states, and one might think that is like many places landlocked. It has two international seaports, if you can imagine that. It has an international border with Canada. It has Duluth, which is an international seaport, and it has St. Paul, Minneapolis, which have the Mississippi River, which is an international seaport. They have access to south and east from international seaports, the most central state in the 48 states, and a state that I have said should be the first state to break away and become independent. It has an international border with Canada. It has two international seaports. It has a high-tech area in Minneapolis, and it has all that it needs for agriculture. It gets 95% of its oil from Canada. The major refineries in Minnesota refine oil from Canada. They don't depend at all on Mideast oil. They don't have pipelines coming in from the south or the other main sources of petrol in the rest of the United States. Minnesota is a unique place. There's no other place that has anything like this unless possibly Wisconsin, but Wisconsin doesn't have large population centers. Okay, moving onward. St. Louis, Missouri. I'm not sure. St. Louis has the fault line running right through it. And so might not be the best place to be. Kansas City might be far enough away from the Yellowstone Caldera. The major eruptions in the past have come out, and as far as Kansas City, it's right on that eastern edge and quite a bit east, almost due east of the Wyoming massive Yellowstone volcano caldera. So Kansas City on my list would be iffy. And these, I'm talking about major events. Chicago, Illinois, not the place to be. Not the place to be. The biggest reason, you have Lake Michigan there. And if make Lake Michigan sluice, it could take out the majority of Chicago in one fell swoop, with a tidal wave right off of Lake Michigan. So if you look also coming out the Great Lakes, Detroit, Cleveland, Buffalo, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, all on the Great Lakes coming out, they all could be potentially places that would be wiped out very quickly. Central, eastern part of the United States, Indianapolis, Cincinnati, Columbus, Louisville, Nashville, Memphis, Little Rock, Jackson, Mississippi, actually a quaint little town. All of those places in Birmingham, Alabama, Nashville, let me see, Charlotte, North Carolina. Looking at some of these other ones, this looks miss. Oh, Atlanta. Oddly enough, Atlanta, in spite of its horrible water conditions, in spite of its other issues, the biggest problem with Atlanta would be the crime problem in the case of a massive outage of infrastructure. I know a lot of people that have moved from Atlanta just because the crime rate, even on the highways, is just a super high crime rate, not a nice place to be. So with any infrastructure outage, Atlanta probably not the place you would want to be. Now going up the East Coast, starting from the south, the Miami, Fort Lauderdale area, toast. St. Petersburg, Tampa, not a good place to be. Daytona, Jacksonville, the big populations of Florida, all, of course, Florida is very low land. There's no large hills or anything in Florida. In terms of tsunamis, that kind of disaster. Then going up Jacksonville, Savannah, Charleston, up the East Coast, places that could possibly fare quite well: Raleigh, Durham, Charlotte, North Carolina, and Charleston, West Virginia, Richmond, Virginia, and then the entire eastern coast. Let's just go up. You look at 20,000, 23,000 people per square mile in New York City, all right on the coastline. Providence, Rhode Island, Bangor, Maine, Boston, all those cities. Oh my goodness. That's where the bulk of the United States lives, in that region, besides Los Angeles and Dallas. There's really three major population areas. It's that whole eastern seaboard up there, and then Chicago, Dallas, and of course LA, I guess more than three, and then up to San Francisco. But about 95% of the American population lives in those few places. The rest of the country is pretty much barren. And then if you cross over into Canada, anywhere along the northern border, from anywhere from, say, Toronto on west, Canada is a very low population country. In fact, it's nearly the lowest population country in the world. So these are areas that would have potential to be not what I would call safe places, but survivable areas. I'm running out of time here. Remember to look at the paid cast. Go to my webpage, all the information there, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.